Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the dialogue on Reality Check Radio. You can text us your thoughts on 2057 or send questions to inbox@realitycheck.radio. And we are joined now by John McLean. He is a New Zealand author, historian, and a qualified lawyer in England who has written a number of books on New Zealand history and Captain Cook and various other subjects. And he's recently published, as of last month, I believe, a book on the British Empire subtitled A Force for Good. And after last week's little mishap due to some technical issues, I messed up. It was my fault. But he's here for real. So good to speak with you, John.
Good afternoon, Jerry.
And this book that you have written, what's the purpose of this book about the British Empire? And what is, I guess, unique or special in 2024 to have a book about the British Empire that hasn't been written before?
I've always been very interested in the empire, and I've been to many of the different colonies and countries, and I've always had a terribly positive impression of it because it has done so much good for so many countries and colonies around the world. And I've got very tired of the negative views of it that are put out by our rather airheaded media and biased academics with what appears to be their soundbite education that tends to judge the past by the passing and shallow standards of the present. And I thought that it was time to write a book for the modern reader, which will give a more accurate idea of what the empire was about. It's based on the facts as they were recorded at the time, and this helps to give the reader an idea of what the empire was really like and what it did or failed to do for those who lived within its extensive bounds. The book describes the way that the various colonies were acquired and developed, as well as giving a lot of little known but important incidents that rarely see the light of day in our modern world of increasingly short attention spans.
And the first place, one of the earliest colonies, perhaps the first colony that you address in this book is the American colonies, the 13 colonies, and you address the American Revolution, and you seem to be quite negative about that, which is in some sense understandable. You know, the impact that the American Revolution had on the British Empire hasn't been particularly positive. And it's also quite rare to have someone, I think, take a negative view of America and a very positive view of the British Empire in history, because so much of it is written by Americans. So what kind of impact did the American Revolution have on Britain in terms of it developing its empire?
First of all, in that chapter that you mentioned, you said that I was somewhat negative. Well, I was really pointing out some important facts which seem to have been lost, because as you can imagine, the whole narrative of this is by the Americans. And they have had this amazing propaganda program in their school curriculums for 200 years, so that everybody believes the same thing, and that is that the British Empire was a terrible thing and the Americans fought against it for their freedom and democracy. Now, that just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. There are three points that I make in this chapter, which I think are quite interesting. The first is that they had to wait until the French power in North America was ended, because they couldn't rise up against Britain so long as the French were still in North America, because then the French would immediately move in and take over the 13 colonies. Since France was a much more powerful country militarily than the 13 colonies were. However, with General Wolfe's victory at Quebec in 1759, followed by the Treaty of Toulouse in 1763, all French territory in North America east of the Mississippi was ceded to Great Britain. So that got rid of the French power and so made it more feasible for an uprising to take place. Now, the interesting thing is that in 1772 in England, the case of Somerset v. Stuart prohibited slavery in Britain. There was a very powerful and growing anti-slavery movement in Britain that was moving to ban slavery everywhere in the empire. And they had this victory in 1772 by getting it banned in England only. And this really scared the living daylights out of the slave owners of America. They were concerned because they had their property in slaves, and they saw this banning of slavery in Britain as the first step in Britain banning slavery everywhere, which is exactly what it did. So it was 1 year after this court case, which banned slavery in Britain, 1 year after that, and I think the timing is important, that the Boston Tea Party kicked off the American Revolution. They knew that if they could terminate British rule, they'd be able to keep their slaves, which is exactly what they did until the Civil War of the 1860s. Of the 56 men who signed the American Declaration of Independence, 41 of them were slave owners, including Jefferson and Washington, and this was their power grab. But of course, they never put it like that. They said that they were doing this in the interests of freedom and democracy. But as the perceptive English writer, Dr. Samuel Johnson, put it, how is it that the loudest yelps for liberty come from the drivers of Negroes? They tried to justify their rebellion by saying that they were rebelling against taxation without representation. But the fact is that there was hardly any taxation in the American colonies at that time. What taxes there were not onerous, and the colonists were not so unbearably oppressed as to justify an armed rebellion against the lawful authority and a subsequent war that killed so many people on both sides. In fact, the American colonies were the least taxed territories on earth. In his book, A History of the American People, Paul Johnson wrote that it is probably true to say that colonial America was the least taxed country in recorded history. Government was small, limited in its powers, and cheap. Therefore, the armed rebellion could not have been about taxation. It had to be about something bigger. And that bigger thing was, I believe, the desire to keep slavery, because after all, the purchase price of a slave was around twice the average income in England. Now, if you look at the average income in New Zealand today, it's about $50,000. So that would be $100,000 per slave. So they were fighting basically for their property rights in slaves. The other point I make, which I don't think has been made before, is this. If this rebellion had not taken place, and if the 13 colonies and their extended territory westward had stayed in a constitutional link with Britain, then I don't believe that either of the two world wars would ever have occurred. Because Germany would never have dared to go to war with such a powerful entity as a Britain that was permanently linked to the entire North American continent. So I think that those are the points that are worth considering.
That was a very interesting chapter to read, and your comments on this and your answers here are very, very good, food for thought. And to the listeners who were listening last week, I actually read out a bit of a recounting of the Battle for Quebec, in which General Wolfe was killed, and that's something that John's just referenced here again. And the British, they fought against the French, and then the Americans turned around and allied with the French to a certain degree as well to fight off the British. And they played a bit of an interesting role there in the Revolution. And the American revolutionaries painted King George as a tyrant, which is very common in propaganda today. But what was he like? What was his supposed tyranny over his empire like?
Oh, I think he was more a fool than a tyrant.
I think, yeah, that's probably a more accurate representation. What kind of impact then did this have on the British Empire? Because I guess the empire was not really a big thing at the time. Perhaps America was one of the first parts of the imperial project. And so what happened after the American Revolution? You know, what impact did it have?
Well, the 13 colonies were only the third most remunerative part of the empire. India was much more important and remunerative, and so were the sugar colonies of the Caribbean. However, as you say, the expulsion of the British from America certainly did have an impact on both Canada and Australia. The impact on Canada was that so many of those who had fought on the British side fled to Canada, and up until then, most of the white population of Canada were French Canadians. And so the loyal American colonists poured into Canada, especially into Nova Scotia and Ontario. And so the American Revolution was really the making of Canada. These people who had fought for the established order in America were very anti-Republican, and they were very fine people. They'd already contributed to building economies in America, And they arrived in Canada with skills and energy that really got Canada going. So that's one impact on the empire. And of course, the other one was Australia, because until the American Revolution, Britain was sending its criminals across to the 13 colonies, especially to Maryland, where they were put to work in the fields. They were given to farmers to work for them and things like that. And with the ending of the link between Britain and America, the new United States government would no longer accept convicts. After all, black slaves were cheaper. So the British had to do something with their convicts because there were so many of them and there weren't enough prisons in England, and they were using hulks in the rivers, old ships that were rotting. So disease would break out on these damp ships, and then that would spread to the nearby houses along the riverside, and then the government would be under pressure. And so they had to find somewhere else to send their convicts. And that's really what got Australia going. As you know, the first fleet of convicts were sent to Australia in 1788. And that was the beginning of the wonderful and uplifting story of Australia, which is the first and only time in history that a jail has become a nation.
And one of the most prosperous nations in the world at that.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yes.
And people talk about the prison reform, prison abolition movement, you know, and so this is perhaps the most successful prison abolition project in history then.
Yes, I would agree with that.
So you mentioned slavery quite a bit here in talking about this. You have several chapters in the book dedicated to slavery and the anti-slavery movement as well.
There's one chapter on slavery and another on anti-slavery, the abolition.
And you take quite an even-handed approach here and explain it quite well, I think, on how every society practiced slavery. And in fact, you know, that slavery was not condemned as sinful in the Bible. You mentioned that, but also how an anti-slavery movement developed, a Christian anti-slavery movement developed over time in the empire. And so what was unique about this in the British Empire?
Well, Britain was the only country that had the will and the power to bring about an end to the international slave trade. And there was a very strong movement in Britain led by people like William Wilberforce and Granville Sharp and other humanitarians to end slavery everywhere. That is, not just the slave trade, but the institution of slavery as well. In 1807, the British passed a statute which outlawed the slave trade. And from then on, they had ships that would go down to West Africa and try to find slave ships, capture them, and liberate the slaves. Now, remember, 1807, this was a very noble and principled position to take, because in 1807, Britain was in deadly combat with Napoleonic France. It was only 2 years after the Battle of Trafalgar, and we were fighting France until 1815. So they took this principled position in the middle of a war, and they were unable to send more than two ships to start with. But then, after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, they were able to send many more ships and also to pressure other countries to abolish slavery. So it was Britain that took the lead in the movement for the abolition of slavery.
And then how much of a focus on New Zealand is there in the book? I haven't got that far yet to reach the Pacific colonies and territories.
Oh, there's only one chapter on New Zealand.
And just for the people listening, it's quite a thick book, just under 600 pages. And the British Empire covers how many different territories did you say it covers?
Well, in the book, I deal with 101 of them.
Wow, 101, that's massive.
Yes, yes. It's hard to believe, really. But the reason was that so many of these native rulers, especially in places like India, Malaya or the Persian Gulf or Zanzibar, they had rather insecure and shaky dynasties. And what they wanted was a guarantee that Britain would come to their aid if anybody rose up against them or if any other dynasty tried to take over their territory. And the word of the British government was absolutely sacrosanct, gold-plated. Therefore, princes and sultans and sheikhs were prepared to give up their authority over foreign affairs and defence, and occasionally internal security, in order to get this British guarantee to uphold their existing entity. And that's why so many territories became British because it was so attractive to the ruling family to link themselves with this terribly powerful empire with by far the greatest navy in the world.
And the core of the empire was the navy, right? It was very much a naval
Yes.
power, and that's why it was able to control all of these territories along the coastline of every single continent.
Yes, but the whole point of naval power, as the American Admiral Mann said, is that you only need to have one or two ships in a particular place. Then if there's a problem in Sarawak or somewhere like that, you just have one or two naval vessels go in and the troublemakers will fold, because they knew that behind those two ships was a huge power, a much larger force that could sail in at any time. So they only really needed a few ships here and there, because the prestige of the Royal Navy and its power was just so enormous.
And just coming back to New Zealand briefly, how impactful was New Zealand to the empire? What kind of a role did we play, you know, as a little country at the edge of the world?
Well, not very much, really, to tell you the truth. We were, as you know, one of the four dominions, Canada, Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand. But we were by far the smallest. And our impact on the empire was actually very small. But of course, we always supported it in wartime. And our economy was very dependent on the British market until Britain joined the wretched European Common Market, which morphed into the even more trade-restrictive European Union. And don't forget that we also relied totally on Britain for our security right up until the Second World War. There was no Royal New Zealand Navy until the 1940s. It was the Royal Navy that gave us protection, and they were always coming in and out of our ports. But the real value of Britain to New Zealand was in the Maori Wars of the 1840s and 60s, when British regiments came here and put down those two rebellions, that is Honeheke's and the Kingite Rebellion. New Zealand was such a small country at that time, and it only had a few very small and ill-trained militias, and we relied very heavily on Britain for our protection. And when it was needed, they came to our aid.
And the eventual betrayal of the Dominions when Britain entered the common market, do you deal with that in the book as sort of, I guess, a final negative thing and a negative ending to the empire?
Yes, I do. And I do it in rather harsh terms, because by 1960, Britain was turning its back on 400 years of prudently and humanely governing many, many territories. And all that the British government wanted to do by then was to quit its imperial responsibilities. And it was a terrible thing, because most of these colonies were not in any state to stand on their own feet, especially in Africa, but also in the South Pacific, where we have so many failed states now. And in Africa, it was terrible. It was just as Ian Smith, the Prime Minister of Rhodesia, said, a scramble to get out of Africa as quickly as possible and without regard for the consequences. And they did so without any consideration for the long-term interests of the people whom they had been successfully governing for generations. And I think that's a very black mark against the British government from 1960 onwards. And they were mostly conservative governments.
And you said a number of colonies became self-governing in the late 19th century, the Dominions specifically already, and before the World Wars, we did quite successfully, and especially here in New Zealand and the other Dominions as well, the settler colonies. I can't quite remember the term that you use in the book, but a system in which they let native societies largely govern themselves, and the British just had oversight on things.
Yes, well, as I said, Britain always liked to govern foreign affairs and defence. And by having control over a territory's foreign affairs, that meant it could keep out all other European powers. And that's what it did.
And then I guess what happened with the independence given to a lot of the colonies, especially in Africa, in the 60s and 70s, you had a lot of communist subversion, basically come in and completely wreck those countries. They'd get independence, they'd get democracy, and they'd get to have like one vote, and then there would be the complete destruction of their economies and societies.
That's right. They got one vote once, and then they would vote in a dictator, and that's the last vote they ever got.
And that's what freedom and democracy looked like as the empire was broken up.
You'd better put freedom and democracy in inverted commas, I think. The thing is that the colonial service was always well paid, and especially in India, where the Indian civil service was the elite core of British administration. They took the very best graduates from Oxford and Cambridge, and they were well paid, and they spent their lives in India governing it very well. The same in the Sudan political service, and the same in the colonial service of all the other colonies. These were well-paid colonial administrators, and they would never dream of taking any decision with an idea of personal gain for themselves. However, the moment that these countries became independent, the new native leaders could not control themselves. And the first thing they did after the Union Jack was lowered was to put their greedy fingers into the public funds. So everything that they could possibly do to enrich themselves, they did. We're talking about corruption with a capital C, big time, all over Africa. And in every ex-British colony there, with one exception, and that is Botswana in southern Africa. Because that country has remained democratic, they have regular elections, and there is virtually no corruption. They continued to employ expatriates to help them govern, and they have been very successful and responsible. Mind you, they were helped by the fact that shortly after they got independence, they suddenly found the biggest diamond mine in the world in their territory. So that has given them a lot of success and wealth, and they have used it wisely. Diamonds were also found in Sierra Leone and the Congo and other places, and they just brought about civil wars between various factions that wanted to get their hands on the wealth. So Botswana is a wonderful example, but sadly, it's the only one.
So what actually happened, which you've described, maybe I should ask why it happened, because you have described sort of what happened to these countries after Britain left, but why did this scramble happen? Why did Britain have to leave?
Well, Britain quit the colonies prematurely before the people were ready to govern themselves.
But why this rush? Why did they just completely give up on their colonies and their empire?
Well, the colonial secretary in the British government, conservative, I might add, Duncan Sandys, told Sir Roy Walensky, the Prime Minister of the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, that Britain had lost the will to govern and just wanted to get out. In other words, walk away from its responsibilities. That's really a betrayal of the people whom they were successfully governing for centuries. Because the whole essence of the empire was that they were guardians of the people. The British never expected to remain in India forever. They always acknowledged that they were governing India until such time as India could govern itself. And that was the case with other colonies as well. But in the 1960s, the British government just turned its back on all this and just wanted to get out. And it was very irresponsible and has caused an awful lot of human suffering. Because the people of these colonies, they've gone back to the chaos, corruption and savagery in which they were living before the British arrived a century or so earlier. They've gone back to being ruled by a small grasping elite, the masses of the people impoverished. I would go so far as to say that the British were the best colonizers that the world's ever seen, and with the exception of Belgium, the worst decolonizers.
And on the whole, then, you mention again in the subtitle of the book here, the British Empire, a force for good, being the subtitle. So did you believe it, that ultimately in a lot of these places then, was there a positive lasting impact out of, over 100 territories that you've mentioned, that the lasting impact of the British Empire has been very good?
Oh, yes, especially in India. We gave national unity to India, which it had never had before, a national language, which was English, which they'd never had before. They had hundreds of languages, as had certain countries in Africa. Britain gave them an honest court system and also did great engineering projects like the Ganges Canal, which irrigated millions of acres, and it really helped to defeat famine, which had always been the curse of India. And they also built things like the Kariba Dam to provide hydroelectricity to northern and southern Rhodesia. They built the Canadian Pacific Railway. other railway bridges, and a lot of important infrastructure projects, as well as giving education to these countries and ever improving health services. Most importantly, Britain's rule of law, refined over the centuries from the time of Henry II, introduced to its colonies an order, safety, and freedom that most of them had never known before. And there are so many benefits, and these are the themes that I mentioned in the book.
You're looking at the index. I haven't got to the point yet of these infrastructure projects, but I saw that you have an entire chapter dedicated to infrastructure projects all around the world, and it's great. Just having a look at the index here for the audience, it's broken up into many different chapters with not quite each province getting its own section, but different regions getting their own sections, and you sort of broken it up alongside the geographical location as opposed to, say, chronological.
Oh, yes. It's the book's interspersed with chapters on other subjects so as to provide variety. For example, there's a chapter on fauna and flora, plants and animals that were taken into different colonies, and then the importance of the district officer or the administrator to keep every district together. A chapter on regiments, one on imperial travel, getting around the empire by land and sea, and in the 20th century by air, and a chapter on the Opium Wars, and another one on Captain Cook, one on women of the empire, and then towards the end, I have a chapter on the pioneers, because I think that they were very, very important in building the empire. It was the pioneers who went out to these countries and developed them. And that's something that historians in England seem to ignore. And then the last chapter is called Loyalty, and it's in two parts. First, the loyalty of the colonials in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, South Africa to the empire in both war and peace. But the other part of the chapter is the loyalty of the Indian Army over many, many years. The Indian Army was truly magnificent, and they fought for England in so many wars, not only the World Wars, where they won so many Victoria Crosses, but right up until 1945. They were just so brave and generous and loyal, and the empire would not have been what it was without the Indian Army. And this is amply explained in the book.
And now, finally, wrapping up here a little bit, where do people buy your books? And is it something that's easily accessible in libraries and so on? But especially if people want to buy the book, where should they go?
Oh, yes, the price is $50, and it's available at certain Paper Plus shops and independent bookstores. But probably the easiest way is to contact our publishing company, because that way we can send the book out within a day or two. And that is www.trosspublishing.com, Tross, T-R-O-S-S, www.trosspublishing.com. And that gives the details of how to order the book.
Yes, excellent. And I got it very, very quickly that way as well. So I would absolutely recommend people go through trosspublishing.com to get the book. And there's a whole bunch of other books there that we could talk about, but I'll just mention very briefly that the publisher has an excellent catalogue of books that you should go and have a look through. In addition to picking up the British Empire book, Tross Publishing has books on New Zealand history, Treaty of Waitangi, and the ongoing effects of treaty settlements. And it would be good to go through some of those in the future, I think. And you yourself have written a number of other books as well. Perhaps you'd briefly like to mention some of these other works that you've written.
Well, the other big book I've written is called A Mission of Honour, The Royal Navy in the Pacific from 1769 to 1997. It's a hardback, and that's also on the list. But I've also written a book called Voyages of the Pioneers to New Zealand, which describes conditions on the sailing ships that brought the early settlers out here in the 1800s. And that's based on the diaries of the passengers. And I've written a book called Sweat and Toil, The Building of New Zealand. And that is about all the infrastructure projects that were built in the 1800s. Mostly by pick and shovel men rather than machinery, wharves and tunnels, railways, roads, bridges, lighthouses, things like that.
In the holidays, the summer holidays and school holidays, I took my family and the kids And we explored some of the tunnels that have been dug, railways and mines through the mountains. And, New Zealand's a very, very difficult country with the topography and high mountains, things like that.
Oh, yes. Are you talking about the South Island or the North Island?
This is just in the North Island, just south of Auckland, between getting through to Tauranga and places like that across the mountains. They dug through those mountains by hand. Absolutely amazing to see those things and still walk through those tunnels. So it's great to hear that you've written a number of books on New Zealand history, in addition to your book here on the British Empire, and that you've been very busy with that. And I want to thank you for that, because sometimes it can be quite hard to find books, good books like that. I have people ask me all the time, where do I get good books on New Zealand history? Where do I get good books on the British Empire in a positive way? Not a revisionist, postmodern, progressive viewpoint. And at least now I've got a really good catalogue of books that I can recommend to people.
Oh, yes. And as I say, they're all based on facts and observations of people of the time rather than on subsequent ideologies.
Well, thank you very much for your time, John. And just for the listeners on the radio, please hang around. We will be right back after this break. So thank you. That was John McLean, author and historian. And if you've got any final advice for people, or just something, one last thing you'd like to say about your book, The British Empire, I'll give you the final word before we move on.
Well, I found that it's not only a great story, but the Empire was such an adventure for those who were involved. It really was so adventurous, and I think that's exciting because there's not a lot of adventure in the world today.
All right. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.